Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Live on History.fm and LiveParanormal.com radio. This is Exploring Mysteries, Histories, and the Paranormal with Dr. John. This is John DeSalvo, your guide for the next 60 minutes, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight. What was it like being a Secret Service man to JFK? Would it be difficult protecting him and the First Lady? Was Lee Harvey Oswald the sole gunman, or is there evidence of more than one shooter? We'll be asking these questions and many more tonight to our very special guest, Joe Paolella. Now, if we have time in the second half of the show, you can call in with your questions to Joe or email them to me. And the number and email are posted at our radio website of Dr. John Radio. That's drjohnradio.com. Joe Paolella is one of 20 Secret Service men still living who protected President John F. Kennedy and the First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. Joe also had the duty of guarding the presidential limousine in which JFK was shot right after the assassination. He has made some keen observations about the car that could shed light on the assassination. Joe also had a long career with the Secret Service in that he has guarded four U.S. presidents. Joe is also one of the top polygraph experts in the country, a well-known private investigator, and president of Joe Paolella Associates in Los Angeles. I've known Joe for several years, and we both share an interest and passion in ancient history. And I think if Joe could have another career, he would be an archaeologist. So we'll have to ask him about that. But it's a pleasure and an honor to welcome my very good friend Joe Paolella to the program. Hello, Joe, and thanks for joining me tonight.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
Hey, Joe, you know, there's always, I think, a mystique about the Secret Service agents. You know, like, are you guys like 007? And I guess my first question to you is, why did you decide to go into the Secret Service, and how were you recruited?
Well, initially, John, I wanted to do something, you know, quite frankly, that might sound kind of corny, but for my country. And I initially wanted to get in the FBI. However, the FBI restrictions were that you had to have a law degree, and I had a regular bachelor degree from the University of Colorado. I majored in psychology and economics. And in 1958, there was a friend of mine who was going into the Secret Service, and he had told me about it, and I said, yeah, I think I'll give it a try. So while at the Chicago office, I applied at the U.S. Secret Service office there, and after about a year of checking me out, they finally gave me a call one time and said if I still wanted to be a Secret Service agent, they needed somebody, and I thought to myself, great. But it sure wasn't for the salary or anything. We were getting, believe it or not, when I think about it, it's hard to believe, $4,980 a year. And
wow.
That was in 1959. The chief of the Secret Service was getting about $10,000 a year, and we used to think, how does he spend all that money? You know, It seemed like a lot of money in those days.
Well, you know, you went into it for all the right reasons, for the dedication, and you know, we many times don't see that today. So you must be congratulated, and you know, again, it's a wonderful thing what you did. Now, who were the other presidents that you were a Secret Service agent for?
I started with Eisenhower, and then President Kennedy, President Johnson, and Nixon while he was the vice president with President Eisenhower. And each president was different, John, and the White House changed to kind of fit the personality of the presidents.
That's amazing.
You
really lived the history of the United States. Were there any of the presidents you really had more of a special relationship or just liked better?
Well, I think President Kennedy probably. I think all the agents would attest to that, John. He was young. He wasn't a hell of a lot older than most of us Secret Service agents. And his wife was young. They were a wonderful, beautiful, vital couple. And the whole era kind of attested to their way of life. And somebody aptly pinned that era as Camelot. And I think it was wonderful.
Hmm. You know, we'll get into the assassination maybe in a little bit, but just some kind of general questions that I think many people were interested in. After the assassination, you know, how did this change your life? I mean, was this something that you really never forgot? Was it just something you had nightmares over? I'm just curious because that was obviously a traumatic experience.
It was, because our reason to be was to protect the president. And it didn't happen. So I think all of us felt that we probably didn't do our job. And it was horrible. I think there was a song written the day the music stopped.
Yeah, that song.
And I think a lot of us felt that way.
I guess you had to have a lot of family support, I would think, and maybe other Secret Service men binding together and maybe reassuring yourselves there was probably nothing you could have done. So, I mean, it's you must remember that day crystal clear. You know, is there anything that stands out on that day? I think weren't you guarding Jacqueline at that day also?
Well, yeah. I did not go to Dallas. I was guarding the place where she stayed most of the time. During the weekday, she very rarely went to the White House. And she stayed in a place called Rattlesnake Mountain. We used to call it Rattlesnake Mountain in Atoka, Virginia, which is about 70 miles from the White House. And it was in the horse country of Northern Virginia. And naturally, that had to be guarded, too, because people would come by and, you know, after a while, the word got out that this is where the Kennedys stayed, and people would come by, and we had it all wired up so we could hear people when they'd stop by the entrance of the property, and they'd say, well, gee, I think this is the White House where Mrs. Kennedy stays, and I or some of the other agents would say, please continue. This is government property. Do not stop. And then you'd hear, oh, wow, you know, we better not stop here or anything like that. It would kind of scare them. But we only had one person per shift. So during the day, a shift was 8 hours, so there'd be three guys on the Atoka detail. And that was the day that I was supposed to work at Atoka, and during the ride to Atoka, Virginia, from Washington, which is about 70 miles, that's when I heard that the president had been shot. And initially, it didn't say anything about being killed or anything. They even mentioned that there was a Secret Service agent who was shot. I called the White House and talked to the head of the White House detail who had not made the trip, and he told me to come back to the White House because they were going to fly the president's car back to the White House, and they wanted me to watch it until the doctors from Bethesda Naval Hospital could come by, and because there was a lot of brain damage, bone, and blood in the car, and they didn't want anybody to touch it or do anything. They were going to use that probably to determine exactly when he died and what caused him to die. So that was my job. So instead of going to Atoka, I returned back to the White House.
Interesting. You know, we'll be talking about when you did guard the limousine, but you, looking back now and looking at history, you had one of the most important jobs, and actually it was possible you may have been able to determine if Lee Harvey Oswald shot President alone, or maybe there was other gunmen. And I guess who knows at that time what, the other thing I was going to ask you, did any of it at that time, because, you know, we hear about the conspiracy much later, did most people just accept it was just one shooter in the Secret Service, or was there rumors going around even at that time that there may have been a conspiracy and additional shooters?
Well, there were many, many people who had many, many different theories about what who was involved in the assassination. I think most guys in the Secret Service and the Secret Service themselves thought that it was one shooter, Oswald. And you know, I don't know for sure if we'll ever know. John, there was a lot of information that was kind of held back, not for any conspiracy reason as far as the Secret Service or government is involved, but people, I think they wanted to wait until most of the people were dead who might have been somewhat involved in this. I don't know if you heard, John, recently Jacqueline Kennedy was interviewed, I believe it was on KBC yesterday, the day before, and this interview occurred about 50 years ago. She did not want this information to come out for about 50 years, and Carolyn Kennedy said that was okay, you can give this information out. And during that interview, she kind of thought it might have been President Johnson who you know, caused the, or was a part of the assassination. But there's never been any actual evidence to show that. And I find it very difficult to believe that the President Johnson or anybody around him could have done it, because it would have taken a 40 or 50 people to be involved in this massive conspiracy. And I would have thought that somewhere, perhaps in a deathbed confession, somebody would have realized what a horrible thing that was. And I would have, in a deathbed confession, say, look, this is what had happened, but that's never happened yet. And the only one that I think could keep it really a secret would be the mafia. Their code of omerta, of silence, it was very strong back then. It's not so strong now, but at that time, somebody could have done something like that and would not get out to the public.
Yeah, that seems like that's one group that has always been implemented in the assassination. You know, when mm-hmm. when it comes up if there was a conspiracy.
Yeah, and, you know, if anybody would have anything to gain by that, it probably would have been the mafia, because, you know, Russia or Cuba or any of those other countries, if they would have, if Kennedy would have been assassinated and Johnson was made president, I think he would have been tougher as far as the Russians or Cubans are concerned than President Kennedy. So there was nothing there that they would benefit by that. But I believe there's a feeling within the mafia that they helped to get him elected, and that Robert Kennedy went after the mafia very seriously. In fact, at that time, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, did not believe in anything like a mafia. But so he started the cases and things against the mafia, and one of the mafia gentlemen by the name of Marcello, Carlos Marcello, was overheard on a taped conversation that if you kill the head of the snake, the tail will die. The head of the snake probably being JFK, and the tail would be RFK. And lo and behold, after after JFK died, RFK was no longer Attorney General after about a month or two when President Johnson took over.
Wow.
These are all conjectures, but I think I would probably have to go with the statement that Oswald probably committed the crime. And
there was too much
evidence. There was powder burns on him that mm-hmm. were the same as on the rifle that was found in the book plaza.
Repository.
So there were too many things, John, that really showed that it was Oswald.
The question I have for you, Joe, again, being in the Secret Service, again, I'm not a gun expert, but I was told by an expert that the rifle that Oswald used, if you had one of the top marksmen using that rifle from there, eight or nine out of 10 shots at the limousine would be missed. That he hit Kennedy from that distance with that rifle was just almost an impossibility. In fact, many times those rifles would explode. Do you know anything about that, the ballistics of that?
Well, not so much the ballistics about that, John, because I was not a ballistic expert, but I was in the Marine Corps, the same as Oswald. And in order to get out of boot camp, you had to at least be a marksman. And I understand
Joe, I think you're getting cut off there. Are you still there?
The course to get through boot camp. Now, it's possible, and I'm kind of a fatalist, and I think when it's your time to go, it's your time to go, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And because he ostensibly was not a real good shot, and the rifle was not real accurate, it might have offset each other. And so he might have become a better marksman than a real marksman. So who knows? I mean, I don't know if this is things that I've heard, John, and may or may not be true. But
sure. It's interesting speculating. Again, I always say, basically, I'm a scientist, and it's fun to speculate, mm-hmm. but you want the data and the facts. And unfortunately, there really is few here. I was kind of disappointed when the remember all the videos and the movies and photographs came out of the civilians taking pictures of the grassy knoll, you know, as the motorcade came by. And in recent years, they tried to enlarge them and enhance them to see if they could see a shooter behind the fence or another person. And unfortunately, the quality of the film was not such that that could be identified or ruled out. So there's still the question. So, I guess there's...
Another unusual thing, too, John, was just before President Kennedy arrived in Air Force One, it had been raining, and the bubble top was on the president's car. Just before he arrived, it stopped raining, and we used to call it Kennedy weather because many, many times the weather would be bad, and he'd get there, and all of a sudden it would brighten up and be real nice. So, lo and behold, bubble top was taken off, and he was in the car. Now, had the bubble top been on, it might have deflected. It wasn't bulletproof per se, but the caliber in the rifle was a very small, like 23.23 caliber bullet, mm-hmm. that would have would have not killed him. The first bullet that hit him might have knocked him over, because I think it hit him in the trapezius muscle, which is a tip there, and that was not a fatal wound, and it might have pushed him over at least, so that he wouldn't have been a
cut off. Maybe we can try to get Joe back on. Anyway, we're talking to Joe Paul Alala, who is one of the 20 Secret Service men to JFK. And I think what we'll do is let's take our half-hour break now and try to get Joe back on the line and get him hooked up again. And I'd like to take some time on the second half to talk to Joe about the presidential limousine in which Joe was guarding, because there was something that Joe observed in the windshield that I never recalled reading in the Warren Commission or anything, and Joe mentioned this several years ago to me, and I did some internet searching and sent the information to Joe, and actually he just got it before the show, and hopefully he'll have time to look at it.
Live Paranormal Radio is the place to be, so join us at liveparanormal.com.
Yeah, that's awesome.
This is Live Paranormal Radio, brought to you by LiveParanormal.com, the number one interactive online community for everything paranormal, horror, and sci-fi.
We're back, and you're listening to Exploring Mysteries, Histories, and the Paranormal with Dr. John. And sorry about that audio glitch. We got Joe back on, and my mic kept going on live and off live, and I didn't know. So luckily I didn't tell any dirty jokes. So anyway, we again apologize for that, and hopefully we won't have any more audio problems to the end of the show. So, Joe, are you back on?
Yeah, I'm back on.
Yeah, again, sorry
it's
about that.
Crazy California probably that might have caused that glitch.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about, I want to kind of get right into the assassination and the windshield, but before I mention that, I know a lot of different people in my life like you had, and I knew somebody who supposedly worked for the government or had inside information, and this story they told me, again, it sounds fanciful, but that JFK had a file card in his pocket with something on it that he was going to announce, and that's why he was shot. So, I mean, you know, it's a good story, but that's about the extent of any inside information I ever heard. So whether he was going to dissolve the CIA or expose the mafia or talk about Area 51, and who knows, I guess we can use our imagination. But the limousine, you mentioned to me years ago, too, that when you looked at the limousine, you noticed a bullet hole through the windshield. Could you tell us a little bit what you remember about that?
Sure. When I arrived to the White House garage to make sure that nothing was taken from the limousine, and to await until the doctors from Bethesda Naval Hospital came in to remove some of the brain tissue and blood and bone and gore, so to speak, in the car, and it was horrible. So I waited around for them to arrive, and they took a while. So I walked around the limousine, and I noticed in the front windshield on the driver's side there was a hole in the windshield, which looked to me like a bullet hole, a crack and a hole. Now, when I had got there, I had heard, like everybody else, that the president was shot from the rear, from the book depository. So I didn't even look to see if there was any glass particles on the inside of the limo, inside of the windshield, which would have shown me that the hole came from the bullet, or a hole came from the outside, or whether the glass particles were on the hood side of the windshield, which would have, you know, that would have really set it off that it was from the back. So to this day, John, and I kick myself thinking I wish I would have checked it out a little bit better to see where the shattered glass fragments were. So I just can't say with any certainty where the glass fragments were, and so I really can't answer the question if it was from the front or from the rear that the bullet or whatever caused the hole in the windshield where it came from.
Interesting. I remember you mentioned that to me several years ago, and I think I was one of the first people you mentioned that to, and I was, you know, very, very honored that you told me, and I never thought about it until I was going to have you back on the show, and then I did some Google searching, thinking maybe in all this time something came up, and I found a couple pictures of the windshield that surfaced, I think, in 85 or around that time, and unfortunately, again, from the photos, I haven't posted on the drjohnradio.com site, and I know I just sent them to you before the show, if you had a chance to look at them, and can you see those? Did you get a chance to look at those photos, Joe?
Yeah, I looked at them, John. I have a microscope here, and I took a look at it. And they're the photo of what I saw, the windshield. And in the photo is a hole and cracks, several cracks around the hole, but nothing more than that as far as the fragments, the glass fragments, which would really probably the most important of all these things would be where the glass fragments were laid to rest, so to speak, you know, on the driver's side or on the mm-hmm. outside of the windshield. But the picture
was it a bullet
that
hole?
You sent me
was does that look like
a bullet
hole?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just curious. Did you
hard to say, too, because you have the double laminated glass that is in all windshields, so that if there's an accident, the windshield doesn't shatter. So you get a little bit different vision of a bullet hole in the windshield than you would if it was in the side of a car or something like that, you know. In the side of the car, just a round hole that goes in the middle, but in the windshield, it appears to be a little bit different.
Interesting. Now, if you look at that, the picture of the windshield that takes about maybe two-thirds of the windshield in focus, to the right, it looks like a blood stain. Do you remember seeing any blood stains on the windshield? I'm trying. I know you're thinking many, many years ago, but you noticed a hole. But how about any blood stains on the windshield?
Oh, I can't say that I did, John.
I'm wondering.
Blood stains all over the car, and it could very well have been one there that because there was so much of it that you didn't. If it was the only blood stain and no other blood stains, then I probably would have taken notice, but. Because, as I said before, there was a lot of blood stains in the car. This was nothing different than what was shown in the rest of the car. So it stand out, John, that I could say that.
I was wondering if, say there's a blood stain, would that shed any light on the trajectory? Or did the bullet, is the crack, like you say, in the windshield from the bullet ricocheting inside, or did it come in through the front, and then obviously that would imply more than one shooter. Fascinating. I mean, I don't think any of this was in the Warren. I didn't read the Warren Commission report cover to cover, but I don't remember seeing anything about the windshield and the bullet holes. This photo showed up in some kind of conference, in 85, and I'm wondering if any research more has been done on this. I mean, with the technology today, maybe the pictures could really be enhanced and something determined.
Sure. I think the windshield has been destroyed, John. I think the car may have been destroyed also. So it would be very difficult to say, you know, what might have happened. I don't remember. I read the Warren Report pretty good. In the book that Jerry Blaine wrote called The Kennedy Detail, I had mentioned something in there, but it wasn't real, you know, wasn't really brought out as much as we're talking about now. So for some reason, it was kind of slid over, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, I'm no expert, but I've for the last 20 or 30 years studied all kinds of mysteries, and sometimes you get a sixth sense of something, and I just feel that this thing that you notice, this bullet hole, the alleged possible blood, could be the smoking gun and determine whether there was one shooter or two. But that's just, you know, my intuition, and maybe we'll never find out. But, you know, I've always noticed as technology advances, we start discovering things of data we had in the past that we couldn't figure out before. I guess, you know, you as a private detective, you know, I've seen this so many times. So, you know, it's funny, too. You know, when I look back at the Kennedy assassination, I was in junior high, and obviously it shocked us. But, you know, when I talk about it now, it's more, you know, science and academics. But you lived through this, and I almost got to apologize for asking you these questions, because I'm sure it must bring back memories many times that you don't want to relive. And I know, besides me, I'm sure the listeners really appreciate you kind of, you know, searching your memory and kind of reliving maybe a time in your life that wasn't a very happy one.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's something that happened. You can't change it. I, in a way, feel honored that I was there at that time. And as far as, you know, giving any information out, I think it's history. I think everything that happened or might have happened should come out. I don't think we should hold anything back. And if this helps find out who did it, great. I have no regrets. I really do think it was a wonderful time. I think he would have made a wonderful president had he lived, you know, for one or two terms. And I think that's something that history will probably mention as the turn of this country. You know, I think the golden age of this country was probably 40s, 50s, maybe 60s or 70s. And sadly enough, it's kind of you know, gone downhill to a certain extent.
That's true. Well, you know, the book, The Kennedy Detail, which you mentioned by Gerald Blaine, again, very interesting book, and some of your stories are in here. But I still think you need to write, you know, I've known you for years. You've got so many fascinating stories, not only with the Kennedy assassination, but you work as a polygraph expert. I know didn't you do the polygraph to the stars at the big trial out there many years ago? And you just got a wonderful reputation of being an investigator, and I hope you do write your own book. If any publishers are listening, you better, you know, grab Joe up before somebody else does.
Yeah.
But I do hope you come out with your own book someday.
Yeah. Well, there was so much that happened at that time, and so much about other Secret Service agents, that when Jerry first started the book, it was really almost going to be a story about each of the Secret Service agents, their backgrounds, why they went into the Secret Service, their remembrance of Kennedy, and we're kind of talking about doing something like that to let the people know more about Kennedy, more about his humor, and he was really a good man, a nice person to be around. Some of the agents really have some very, very interesting stories, personal stories about him. And her, he and she knew, you know, all the agents' names, their wives, their children, when they had birth dates, and different things like that. I remember going to a Christmas party that Mrs. Kennedy had for just the agents and the children and their wives. So they were really, really nice people, and it's sad for the country that this happened, and I think it's even sadder that to some extent that JFK Jr. died, because he was a wonderful kid. All the Secret Service guys loved him and thought, boy, wouldn't it be nice to have a boy like that? He had that Kennedy charisma, and people liked him. From the poorest people to rich people, he was just one of those kind of guys that persons that seemed to have a knack with people. And he would have been a great president. Would have followed JFK's legacy.
I was just thinking of that. Yeah, it would have been a wonderful legacy. You know, I Joe, I got to mention, Joe, you're such a fascinating person. I met you through a mutual friend who I didn't realize passed away, which was Chris Gugas, who was a president of the American Polygraph Association, and actually, as you know, did the polygraph on James Earl Ray, who shot Martin Luther King. And I think you and him became partners, if I'm not correct, right, in the
yes,
business?
Yeah,
and then
we did.
Joe and I were, Chris and I were,
all
were
said,
good. Yeah, we were
good
friends
man.
Back in the 80s, and then I lost touch with him and tried to contact with him, and lo and behold, I get you, and it turns out we have so many things in common, and it was just amazing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you've known, I'm sure, so many fascinating people just by being a Secret Service. Would you do it all over again? Maybe that's a kind of
a
strange question.
Oh, are you kidding? I'd love to do it. That was kind of like, you might say, you know, everybody has kind of a great point in their life, and I think that was mine, and maybe it was kind of a early part of my life, because I'm in my 80s now, and that was in my 30s, and and to say that was the climax of my life is kind of maybe overstating it. But of everything that's happened to me, and I've had a pretty interesting life, that stands out. So it was great. I wish I could have done it for longer. I wish he would have been around longer, but that's the way it is.
Interesting. You know, so you were Secret Service to Eisenhower too, right? Secret Service agent to Eisenhower.
Yeah, that's where I started.
That was your earliest. Do you remember anything about Roswell that was brought up that you heard when it happened, and the allegedly Majestic 12 were a group of, high-level scientists and government officials who were involved in investigating Roswell. But when that happened in 47, do you remember hearing anything about that?
Oh, yeah. I was kind of interested. I went to, I was in the Marine Corps, and then I went to school in Colorado, which is not too far from that area. And I was in a fraternity, Sigma Chi fraternity. One of the fraternity guys was from that part of New Mexico. So, it was kind of close to home. Now, as far as anything official, as far as the White House is concerned or anything, I'd never heard anything about that or any secrecy or anything of that nature. And it never really came about after that short period of time when I was going to school in Colorado. But there again, I think if it was conspiracy, especially a government conspiracy, John, I just don't think your government people, soldiers, or anybody that might have been around at that time could have really kept it a secret. I think, getting back to what I mentioned about deathbed confession, a lot more people would have come out and say this or that. I just think it's very difficult for a secret that involves so many people could be kept a secret for such a long time,
Yeah, you said something important before, too, like a deathbed confession. You would think somebody out of all those people would have.
You would think so, John.
I'm sure, my God, there are a number of questions coming to mind that just something simple like, JFK and Jackie, is there anything about their person? Oh, well, let me ask you this. Were they, either of them had an interest in spiritualism or the occult or, something in that line that you noticed?
Well, not like, like you heard with Nancy Reagan and being
like astrology
believed in astrology and things. she was a very spiritual person. He was a Catholic. Maybe not the best Catholic in the world. I remember we used to have to go to church with him, and a lot of Secret Service guys would kind of, you know, wonder about it because they never had any money. So when the basket came around for donations, he'd always bow $10-$20 from any of the Catholic Secret Service guys who were with him at that time. So, but he was a down to earth kind of guy, and he loved to read. I mean, he'd read something like eight or nine papers every day. We'd get all kind of papers, so I kept up with worldly events, and I would think that, you know, being an inquisitive kind of a person, other things would have crossed his path, so to speak, and he might have been interested in it. I think she was more spiritual and also a reader, but I don't ever remember anything out of the ordinary where she ever had any, you know, spiritualists or any kind of people like that at the White House. But, you know, people who are inquisitive and intelligent, I'm sure would, you know, you wonder about things. You wonder about what's next, or what else is there in life, or what don't we know about. I would imagine that would cross their minds in many occasions.
Interesting. You always wonder, because you sometimes never hear that side of famous people. Obviously, they want to keep it quiet and confidential. But, you know, for me being interested in metaphysics and the occult and doing research in that area, I always wonder, like Elvis Presley supposedly, before he died, was very interested in, started to get interested in spiritualism. In fact, one of the stories, which I think was documented, he asked a good friend of his, get me the best book on the Shroud of Turin that you know of. And he got a self-published book by Frank Adams. And actually, that was the last book he read before he died. And actually, Frank Adams and I co-authored a book on the Shroud years later. So that was actually the prototype of our book. I didn't know that. Once somebody wrote to me and said, you know, the book you were involved in was the last book Elvis read. And I said, wait a minute, I wrote the book after he died. But very interesting. And spoke to a guy who had memorabilia by him, and he had some spiritual books supposedly in his possession. So interesting. Anything else you want to add? I mean, I could obviously talk to you for 10 hours.
Along those lines, it was interesting that the last book he read had a kind of a spiritual meaning. He wasn't even a Catholic, but to read something about the Shroud of Turin would have been a wonderful thing to, if you really felt that this was something from Christ. And ironically, he read the last book before he died. He might have had some kind of a feeling about it. You know, who knows? Kennedy, before the trip to Dallas, some of the people would say, you know, it's a dangerous place to go because of a lot of super right-wing people were putting ads in the paper and telling him that if he came to, you know, Dallas, that something was going to happen to him. And people kind of tried to talk him into going. And he said, look, if somebody is crazy enough to want to shoot me, it doesn't care what happens to him, they could probably do it. So it was brought up shortly before his death that this could happen, and you know, he did make mention of it. So he might have had some kind of feeling that this might have happened.
Do you keep in touch with your fellow Secret Service men that are still living that were with you at that time?
Oh yeah. Sure, we every year we get together and have a meeting with the other, not too many of us left, not too many of us can walk, I'm just being facetious on that, but it's, you know, sounds corny, but it is a brotherhood.
Well,
and,
it seems to really support each other too, I guess, and throughout the years.
It was a good time to be alive. You know, I really look back at it as, you know, thank God that I was able to be there. And I think I, as all the other agents, feel that if you know, people say, "Would you really give your life for the president?" Then we would.
You know, I only got about 4 minutes left, and Cuban Missile Crisis. And you were with him, weren't you, during that time?
Oh yeah, well, that was a very
anything of importance you want to mention about that?
Well, kind of interesting things. I think I don't think people realize how serious it was, because there were helicopters flying around the White House, ready to pick up the president, first lady, and some of the cabinet to take them over to a kind of a hidden place. We used to call it Crystal Mountain, where it was practically impenetrable. And we were told, though, that because the helicopters could only carry so many people, that if the person wasn't you know, allocated to get on the plane, that they were not we take whatever action we could to keep them from getting on the plane. So you know, it could have been, if anything would have happened, it could have been horrible, really. What do you do if people are rushing the helicopter and trying to get on, and only a certain amount of people could do it, and the other people got on, it would be too heavy, and it couldn't take off. So there was a pretty rough decision there. A lot of us sent our wives back to where we came from before, because we really thought that there was a good chance that there could have been war. You know, the Russians were getting closer and closer to Cuba. And Kennedy gave Khrushchev the ultimatum: you go any further, and that's it. And there were a lot of people too. I mean, you know, hawks and doves that were saying, "No, don't do it. Don't start a fight." His brother, I think, probably kind of pushed him to do what he finally did. Bob Kennedy was, you know, pretty tough little guy, and JFK listened to him, and I think that was a decisive factor that, you know, don't let him get any closer.
Wow, you know,
and he told them, and they turned around, so nothing happened, but something could have happened.
You know, for those who are younger and didn't live through this, you know, and I was a young person, but it was frightening. I mean, we really thought we were at the edge of atomic war and nuclear holocaust.
Well, you had a right to be frightened, John, because it could have been. Who knew? I mean, it was, the impression at that time is that Khrushchev really didn't think too much of JFK. He thought him as kind of a young whippersnapper and not real tough. And,
you know, we're getting towards the end here of the show. I got to say, this has got to have been one of the most, even though I've known you for several years, this is one of the most fascinating interviews I've ever done. And, oh, my God, I just could continue. By the way, next time we talk, what fraternity were you in, Joe, again?
Sigma Chi.
Oh, I was in Chi Phi. We're going to exchange Animal House stories, okay?
Okay.
We'll see which frat was more Animal House. I think mine's going to win, though.
Okay, John, and I appreciate you having me on.
You know, again, it really, really is an honor to have you on, and I guess I want to thank you so much, Joe, for taking the time. Hope we get you back on again. And listen, God bless you, and you stay well, okay, Joe?
Thank you.
That was Joe Paolalala, a Secret Service agent to John F. Kennedy. And again, I'm just kind of speechless after this. What a fascinating, fascinating interview and stories by Joe. Again, I could go on and on. So I hope you enjoyed it also. And again, we got to relive history tonight. And anyway, I want to thank my special guest, Joe Paolalala, for being with us tonight, and liveparanormal.com for hosting the program, and Rob, the owner, and Carl at Master Control. But most especially you, the listener, for joining us tonight. And I hope you join us again next week for another special guest. And don't forget to check out our radio archives at drjohnradio.com, where you can listen to past programs and download them, see our upcoming guests, and information about our past guests or books and websites. And again, I thank you for being with us tonight. And until next week, good night, and may God be with you.